comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, talk radio like nowhere else on earth. It's the show where you matter. Let me remind you, or for those of you who are brand new and don't know about it, you need to make sure that you are subscribed to the K-Files. It's our free weekly newsletter. And you subscribe by going to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, click where it says K-Files, and in just a couple of seconds, you'll be subscribed, okay? So be sure you do that. It really is free. There are no strings attached. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to as well. News in the Gary McKinnon case. You know, this case has been with us now, I guess, since 2002. Since 2002... Gary McKinnon has been dealing with the problem of having been arrested in the UK by UK police over computer attacks on US military systems that took place back in 2001. In 2005, an extradition treaty was signed between the US and the UK. And the U.S. then filed for extradition on Gary McKinnon. And he's been fighting that extradition ever since. Well, the new development is that there's a new government now in the U.K. They've just had their elections, and they've got a new government and a new cabinet. And so what was coming up May the 25th and May 26th was a judicial review, which was really pretty much their last possible venue to try and get extradition stopped. But Gary McKinnon's lawyers have now written to the court requesting a cancellation of this hearing pending a cabinet office ruling in the case, expected to arrive as soon as Thursday. So maybe by tomorrow we will know what's going to happen with Gary McKinnon. You know, we've talked about this many times on the show, and the audience is pretty evenly split. Some people think he should be extradited and stand trial because he has admitted that he broke into those computers, that he hacked into them. Some people think that he should not be. You know, regardless of whether you think he should be or should not be extradited to the United States, I do think this thing needs to come to an end. They've had this guy on the hook now for, 8 years. And, you know, enough's enough. Make a decision one way or the other and then get on with it. This guy needs to be able to live his life, don't you think? One way or the other. Live his life as a free man in the UK or live his life in prison. But, you know, you got to get this stuff settled one way or the other. We'll be back right after this break, so don't go away. Thank you. Sean Belekharov. I have to think about that before I say it. The rhythm of the name is a little bit difficult for me, but I can read it. Sean Belekharov is my guest this evening, and he is the founder of a paranormal investigation organization called Spooks. He is also the author of a book entitled 2012, The Paranormal Cookbook. As per our usual practice, if you click on his photograph on my website, it will take you to his website. He and his wife work together in investigating paranormal phenomena and very often simply goes by the name Sean B. But whether it is Sean Belekharov or Sean B., welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. We're delighted to have you this evening.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. We got a storm system moving through here, and it was kind of shaky in the intro, so if it cuts out, I sent you a cell phone try for a backup line.
Okay, very good. Sean, let's just start out with this. Now, I took the time to go through your website rather thoroughly, and by the way, a very impressive website.
Thank you.
Well, you deserve to hear that. It's a lot of work has gone into that. Now, on your website, I discovered that you approach the investigation of paranormal phenomena from a little bit different perspective than other paranormal investigators, in that you view paranormal phenomena as directly linked to certain psychological dynamics. Let's jump in right there and elaborate on that just a bit, if you will. Explain to us what you mean by that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm lucky because I kind of had the luxury to believe in the paranormal and not be kind of hindered in having to prove it one way or another. I'm just kind of out there to experience it, so we're a little different than that. My wife is originally from South Korea, and she's her mother was Mundang, which is basically like a Korean shaman, and she's kind of from that bloodline. Her mom, she's consulted by Buddhist monks and even the first female presidential candidate in Korea, so that kind of helps, I think, with what we do. A lot of just from personal experience, like whenever I take her out to a location, we'll run, you know, almost 30% hits on anomalies on film, as opposed to if I go out by myself or with another like-minded individual, where we run about 2 to 5%. Most recently, we was at this little cemetery. I mean, it's just a dinky little spot. It's called Kindred Rose here in Missouri, where we're based out of. And she was getting, you know, about 30% hit rate, you know, about one out of every three photos she was getting something. And on one of them, she got an orb, which I don't put too much stock in an orb, especially if they show up on digital cameras. But this one was kind of interesting because it had the basically the look of the Pepsi logo, which is relevant because if you look at the Korean flag, South Korean flag, it's basically the red and the blue yin-yang surrounded by the I Ching sticks. So I think that probably there was something there that she photographed that was, you know, something that somebody else would have photographed would have showed up as well. But I think that, you know, kind of she projected some of her personality and some of her psychological connotations onto the phenomena, which is kind of interesting because you see more of a direct interactive effect as opposed to the kind of this idea that we're just observers.
Okay, so are you saying then that the phenomena is going to exist, but what you see in the phenomena is based on certain psychological dynamics within yourself? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a perfect example would be the often cited alien fairy, you know, connection. In psychology terms, it's basically called like the cultural source hypothesis. But basically, what you see with the aliens and the fairies, they basically have the same dynamics working. You have the light from an unknown source. You have the sleep paralysis, the levitation, both the fairy rings and crop circles. You have the alien hybrids and the fairy children. Both of them are, you know, being replaced and or taken and replaced by these magical entities or whatever. You see the fairies and the aliens, the greys at least, are both have feminine features. very diminutive in stature. So I think what you're seeing is this, it represents something that's a real phenomenon that's happening, but it's just a matter of how we interpret the events, and that's kind of, I think, a part of the whole perspective. And when you get into quantum physics and all that fun big brain stuff, you kind of see that expectations and belief systems are very relevant and very much do kind of crystallize manifestations and do kind of create the reality that we believe it'll be.
Well, now let me ask you this. Do you think that it's operating on that quantum entanglement theory, or do you think that it's possible that these entities can read our thoughts and can see what our cultural background is and present themselves in a way that fits a frame we already understand?
Right. No, that's an excellent question. And the bottom line is you really can't answer that because, you know, we are only perceiving through anything that we experience happens goes through our own personal perceptual filters. So, you know, we can only kind of assess what we consider to be physical evidence and this type of stuff. But at the same time, you know, the experience is what counts, because what our belief systems and all the great religions are based on this too, as at the beginning, of course, is that experience is very much more impactful on your personality, on your belief system, than just the written word or stories. Because when you experience something, it's something that you incorporate fully into your worldview. It becomes part of you. It assimilates. Whereas if you read something, it's you may or may not take it, or if you hear a story, you may or may not believe it, depending on the teller and so many other variables. But when you experience something, it's there. It's locked in. So I think that's almost a real more concrete reality than what we learn through academic studies and these type of things.
All right. Now let's back up. Yeah. And let's get into your background a little bit. Your family history is pretty interesting.
I didn't know until I started poking around that it does have some twists and turns. And
well, you've got both some historical things that are interesting historically, as well as some things that are interesting from a metaphysical point of view.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about your background, and then we'll talk about this, how that led to your work and your book.
Absolutely. Yeah. On my dad's side, he's from the old country of Russia. He's I'm a first generation U.S. citizen, you know, born and bred here. So he came from the old country, as they called it. They left basically around the time of World War II. They were detained at a work camp, and my dad had a near-death experience, which was possibly, you know, key in having some of the, you know, experiences that he's had, because a lot of times you see with the shamans and healers and people that kind of work with spirits, which he doesn't that much, but I mean, you see near-death experience in a lot of times, you know, including all the way to the shamans of the Tungus region down in Russia. So anyhow, they got over here, and just back in the old country, we kind of had a reputation as being a little bit historical-minded, but also a little bit nutty. I had a great-great-uncle that was one of the founders of a historical academy, the first historical academy in Leningrad, Stalingrad, whatever you want to call it, whatever it was at the time. We also had another great-uncle, great-great-uncle that was an archaeologist / anthropologist, and he kind of would go poking around in caves that nobody would like going into because they're bat-filled, or checking out the haunted forests to deal with some of the Aboriginal folks, and his family, you know, family story has it. I don't know if this is true or not, but he was personally evicted by Trotsky when the Reds kind of took over power. So that's a little bit of what, you know, the background is. So we kind of had that, you know, I had that predisposition to be kind of nutty and eccentric, so I think that I can play that up a little bit. And I love Russia because it's the quintessential East and West type thing. You have the Western logical system that's in place there, but at the same time you have the Eastern mysticism. So it's quite the paradoxes. So what was it, Kissinger or Churchill? Whoever said it was, the enigma and the paradox. And it's very interesting. So.
Well, it is, and you know, it's. It's very interesting. Some of the best scientific minds on the planet are either in Russia, or if we're talking about in the past, where you can say they're from Russia.
Right.
I mean, really, some of the most brilliant scientists ever have been from there. And yet there's a huge body of mystical and metaphysical lore from Russia as well.
Yeah, that's why I want to hit that up in another book, just kind of deal with the East, because since my wife is from South Korea, I really want to make the trek out there and kind of check out her stomping grounds, and I think that would be really neat, especially, you know, considering her mom's lineage and stuff. They lived in a temple out there, so there's a couple places I want to check out there, and love to hit up Russia, because there's, like you said, there's just such a history there, and it's so humongous. Just the region is so gargantuan beyond measure, you know, so
mm-hmm.
a lot of history.
How did this lead to you being involved in paranormal investigation, you personally, and then to writing this book, 2012, The Paranormal Cookbook?
Just as I was growing up, I was a voracious reader, so I had a natural interest for all things, you know, but it kind of got a little more specific down to the strange as I got a little bit older, you know, 10, 11, started just really trying to digest everything I could on all the paranormal, supernatural, Fortean, strange, you know, unexplained phenomena around the world. So with that in mind, you know, I kind of did the route I think a lot of people do at the kind of the teenage years, and just started hitting some of these, you know, locales that had legends and myths and whatever surrounded them, and just started kind of observing some things on my own. Groups kind of came later. I've had a couple partners over the years, and most recently, of course, with me and my wife, we have spooks. But it's just, you know, like I said, it's getting out there in the experience. I think that's what's more fundamentally, you know, important to me, more than any of the rest of it. And I kind of wrote from that perspective, the cookbook from that perspective.
All right, well, but before we get into the book, let me ask this. And you've mentioned it, and I've mentioned it, the organization Spooks, S-P-O-O-K-S, and there's on your website, there's a period beside each one, so it's S period, P period,
exactly.
And so forth. What does that stand for?
Springfield Paranormal Organization Operating with Kinetic Surveillance. I was trying to fill out something that filled out Spooks, because I liked the name. Somebody suggested it. I liked the name, so I had to fill in the blanks. It was like a crossword puzzle from beyond the grave or something, you know, just plug it all in. So that's what I came up with, and I stick with it. So,
all right, let's talk about the book, 2012, The Paranormal Cookbook. What is this about?
The Paranormal Cookbook, the title itself kind of points towards the direction. We take a lot of different looks at a lot of aspects of the paranormal. We kind of look at the recipes for manifestation of the phenomena, and that's kind of what we tried to address. The 2012 is kind of a nod to the idea that 2012 offers a focal point where most of society, if not all of the world, is going to be kind of focused in on this singular point, and that, you know, leads us with certain opportunities that we probably haven't really had before, you know, even with the Y2K thing, because the internet wasn't full blown then. So on the cover, we kind of have a nice little parody. I like this. I got to give all credit to the artist, because I gave it to her. It was stick figures, literally. It's kind of a parody of the dogs playing poker. We've got the Ledger's Joker is in the middle, and then we got the Man in Black, the alien, and werewolf kind of just throwing down on a poker game. So I wanted to express my appreciation to the artist for that, Carolyn Cameron, because she did a good job with that. So,
all right. If I buy this book, what can I expect to be confronted with?
Okay, let's see. Well, we talk about, of course, the 2012 date, and we kind of go into some of the prophecies and some of the ideas that are kind of surrounding that. We touch on the curse of the Joker and the return of the Phantom Clowns. We talk about quantum physics, observer effect, and kind of synchronicity, and kind of how these are universal road signs for universal consciousness. We talk about window areas, flap activity in the interactive universe. We talk about our new theory of environmental archetypes and hauntings, tulpas, golems, thought-projected forms like Philip the Ghost, the occult werewolf theory. We talk about the trail of the Hellhound of the Ozarks, which was case that we investigated here down here in Springfield. That was the first time we read about that. So we talk about the Goat Man a little bit. We talk about the Loch Ness Monster being a shapeshifter profile on Black Eyed Kids. So we try to touch on really a lot of stuff.
All right. Now, we have just a little more than a minute and, well, a couple of minutes, and we'll be into our next break. But what is the window theory? You mentioned that.
Yeah, the idea that certain places are basically windows, where they're, at certain times these windows will be open, basically, and there are areas where you have high strengthness, you have multiple kinds of phenomena that are manifesting over periods of time. A classic window place would be like Skinwalker Ranch. Another one would be the Mothman area down in West Virginia, but that would probably be more consistent with the flap idea.
Now, what's the difference between the flap and the window theory?
The flap is basically just a condensed area, window of time, basically. It's just a kind of a one-time shot type deal, whereas a window is something that's always there and kind of just opens and closes at will. The flap is just... like the Mothman thing occurred over 13 months, and after that, it basically kind of cooled out. So that's the flap as opposed to the window.
Okay, so a window then would be what you're describing as the window theory. Some people refer to it as a portal or something like that.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It would be very consistent with the Native American idea or the European idea of portals and energy spots in the earth.
Are there a lot of those places?
No, they're pretty rare, but I mean, part of it is the psychology of the people that are investigating any place. I think a lot of what we bring to a site is reflected in how the paranormal manifests. So if you're at a place that has a legend, you're more likely to anticipate the activity and it's more likely to manifest, but at the same time, you're more likely to shape it because you have that interactive stuff. And the interactive universe is really kind of present. And like if you look at the Mothman models and the Skinwalker Ranch, where you had all these different types of phenomena manifesting and just kind of evolving as the investigators investigated it. So.
Okay, we have a break coming up here in about 5 seconds. And when we come back, I want to talk with you just briefly about people who are absolute non-believers in the paranormal and what happens when they are confronted by it. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Sean Belekaroff, and we're talking about the paranormal. He is a paranormal investigator and author, and we're talking about the paranormal from a little bit different perspective, a little bit different spin on the front end of the paranormal than what you normally run into. And, Sean, when we went away for break, I said I wanted to ask you a question about people that are complete non-believers. Now, I'll tell you, let me set this up a little bit. I'm not a believer, nor am I a disbeliever in paranormal or UFOs. What I say is either something exists or it doesn't. There's nothing to believe. If it exists, it does. If it doesn't exist, it doesn't, and that's that. But what about someone...
Quandary, huh?
Do what?
No, I said, but therein lies a quandary, huh?
Well, if I see it, it exists. If I touch it, it exists. Okay? Now, what about someone, though, who is caught up in the believe, don't believe fabric of fiction? And... to the point that they say, I mean, a ghost could appear, pick up a hammer, and hit them in the head, and they'd swear it didn't happen.
Right.
They absolutely do not believe. Okay. In fact, they disbelieve. Absolutely disbelieve. Okay. And then one day, it happens. one day this disbeliever sees an apparition. Okay. How does your theory about the certain psychological dynamics being connected to the paranormal phenomena work in that case?
Okay. Yeah, that's those often make the most compelling witnesses, because those are the people that have certain ideologies and certain set belief systems, and the fact that they do encounter something that is beyond their scope, and that they are willing to go on out and say, you know, I witnessed this, then, you know, that's some of the most compelling testimony, and I talked about that just recently. But, yeah, absolutely, there is a certain amount of, you know, good and bad, and the duality of nature and these type things. There is a certain amount of that in the universe. I think there has to be for there to be balance. So I think there are extremes, but I think it's just kind of dangerous to have extreme views on either believer or skeptic side. And skepticism is an absolutely necessary element that we have to have if we're going to ever try to prove anything, you know, to science or whatever, which is not my intention. But if we're going to do that, but at the same time, we can't mistake skepticism for cynicism that's just, like you were talking about, just was unwilling to look at the possibilities. And that's, you know, a lot of the old guard science was kind of that way. It didn't matter. Basically, the idea in the West is if we can't explain how the mechanics of something works, we don't believe it works. It doesn't matter if it's repeatable in experiment labs. It doesn't really matter. Like, we just accepted, you know, acupuncture in the last 20, 25 years. But now we know the kind of the mechanics behind it. So it's just something that we have to understand the steps of what we're seeing here in the West as scientists before we really validate the experience.
Yeah, but now, more specifically now, yep. this guy is an absolute disbeliever. He's a cynic.
Yeah.
How is this apparition that's appearing to him, this phenomena that's happening, connected in any way to psychological dynamics with him? Because his mind is saying it ain't so.
Right. Doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Yeah, absolutely. That would have to be, you know, it's a bit of a hole, but that would have to be the 15% that, you know, or whatever, you know, percentage you want to say that is part of that absolute dynamics that actually does exist and does interact. And, you know, you can't discount the subconscious cues, too, because there's a lot of times our body language, even just looking at our body language, where we're saying one thing, but our body is setting off totally different signals, and there's people that make, you know, a living doing that for Fox News and other organizations. So I think that we can't discount that, but at the same time, yeah, I think that it's not something that is applicable in every situation, but I think when you're talking about when you're at places that have paranormal activity, these places that have that legend and that mythos attached to them, I think you're dealing in places that are kind of psychologically kind of extreme positions. It's places where we're already kind of stepping into untested waters, so I think the dynamic is more pronounced there, as opposed to the everyday is kind of the normal, and you don't see it as pronounced because it's not this extreme situation. But that would just, you know, be my answer for that.
Okay, then, so the psychological dynamics being connected with the phenomena, as I understand what you're saying, is that if I'm psychologically more open-minded about this, I'm probably more likely to see it happen.
Yeah, and we've absolutely seen that in the sheep and the goat dynamic, and with the parapsychology research of J.B. Ryan and all those cats down at Duke, Bachelador, and some of these other guys that have you know, really done a lot of lab work and under controlled environments and you know, limited variables, and have shown that, you know, not only if the person taking the test is a believer, but also if the person giving the test is a believer. If both of those are believers, the statistical probability is statistically higher than what it would be if it was, you know, a non-believer believer or two non-believers. And the two non-believers usually score statistically significant below the expected average. So I think there's definitely part of that whole phenomena. They call it the jealous phenomena. So I think it's very much, it wants to be paid attention to. If it's paid attention to, then it tends to amplify.
All right, let's move to something else that you mentioned that's in your book. You talked about several cases, and you mentioned some of them. And one of them is something that we've talked about on this show, But there's precious little information available out on the internet about it, and that is the black-eyed kids or black-eyed people. There's a little bit of information out there, but there's not...
And we're starting to see a trickle-down effect. We're seeing mm-hmm. more reports come in.
Who are they? What are they?
Well, that's the question, right? The Black Eyed Kids, probably along with Chupacabra, are probably like the it monsters of the internet. The encounters do seem to have some patterns that we can assess from mostly people. Some people have written us and kind of told us about their encounters, and we always encourage that. You know, you can go to spooksfield.com and just drop me an email, and I definitely... take all these cases into account, and we'll get a hold of you and work it out. But just, you know, between people emailing me, people writing me, and taking some that I was able to verify, at least the person, you know, giving the story was the person that was connected to it on the internet. We developed a little bit of a profile, and basically what you see is these kids. The encounters will usually involve 2 to 5 kids. Most often it's a pair of them, ages 11 to 17, somewhere in that range. Of course, they have the all black eyes, which is where they get their title from. At first they startle you because they knock on your car window or on your door, and you're kind of a little bit startled. You roll down the window or you open the door a crack, and you ask them, how can I help you, whatever. Usually, of the two, there's a smaller one and a bigger one. The smaller one is the talker and seems shifty and pretty on the ball and a little bit, a little bit off. Then you have the bigger guy who's usually mute or says very little. It's kind of a Lenny and George mice and men type thing. They'll give you a story. It'll have a pretense. My friend was in an accident. Can I use your phone? Or our car is broke down. Can you give us a lift? A lot of times in some of these encounters, and as it was in the first encounter that was talked about by Brian Bethel, he had no intention of letting him into this car, but he looked up and there's his hand moving towards the lock, so it's almost like he was hypnotized. Another thing that's very common with them, they'll be very persistent. You have to let us in, you have to invite us in. That phrase turns up as well. So.
And what happens if you do let them in?
Well, that's the same thing as what happens to the guy that gets caught by the werewolf. There's no story, I suppose. The idea being that they get you, the idea being that basically not that moment, but usually you'll meet harm through some kind of accident is the general tone. But that's I haven't found any cases that I've been able to verify any of that. And it's only I've only seen it actually in like one or two of the stories, and like I said, I couldn't verify it. So,
sounds like they're death angel apprentices.
A little bit, yeah. Whenever they finally do take off, they also have a tendency to disappear around corners, going into alleys where there's no exit, going into stairwells where there's no exit. This type of thing. So, with those, we see the thing that people have been saying kind of is that these things may be vampire demonic, which is a general apt analogy because you have the black eyes, which is suggestive, but you have the hypnotic kind of trance gaze going on, the need for the invitation and the disappearing. These are all traits of demons, but most notably in the folklore of the vampires. So some less obvious aspects that we were able to kind of pull in with just kind of the geographic locations where these were going on and kind of this type thing. Was the encounters occur most often in cities. It's usually metropolitan-type settings, most often along the east and the west coast. They frequent apartments more than houses. They're also frequently encountered at coffee shops, so apparently the work of the undead is exhausting. So.
Oh, my goodness. So they're addicted to caffeine.
Yeah, so next time you're at your local Starbucks, don't upset the pretentious, all in black poser poet there. It might actually be one of the black eyed kids there. So, yeah. But okay.
So let me ask you this. How many of these reports of the black eyed kids have we had? I mean, is this very prevalent? Is it?
I've had about 10 people contact me through email. I've had 4 mail, snail mail letters, and probably 4 or 5 others that I've been able to verify the person, at least, of the story. There's probably maybe 70, 80 stories on the line that I've come across, and most of them are done on websites where it's a one-time poster, and they just post their one account, and there's no way to verify anything. And that's kind of a little frustrating, because you know that. But that's, you know, that's the internet world that we have. You know, we do have all this access, but we still have the you know, anonymity, and sometimes that wins out, and we're not able to contact the people that actually posted these things. So that's why we've only been able to talk to 4 or 5 people, you know, and actually verify, you know, their actual person. So, but there's a lot of stories out there. I mean, you can go to About Paranormal, or you can go to a lot of websites and. I think Ghost Village and people just kind of write their encounters in, and there's quite a few stories out there. So we did do one last bit of a profile, and this is a bit of a stretch because we're basing it on limited information, obviously, but it was something that we did see a pattern with, and I thought it was very interesting. In a high number of these cases, the kids encountered were wearing checkered clothing, which is a kind of a tie-in with the occult. They wear contemporary clothing, you know, what you would expect kids their age to wear. But there's a checkered hat, checkered shirt, checkered hat, pants. There's something checkered in more than would be expected of these encounters. That kind of ties in a little bit to the, you know, the Kielian grinning ghost and some of these other occult things. The other thing that we noticed is that...
We're going to have to wait till we come back from this break to get the other thing you noticed, because the break is taking over and we've got to step away. We'll be, pardon me, we'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Sean Belekaroff, or Sean B. And we're talking about this whole field of the paranormal from the perspective of it being linked to psychological dynamics. Now, Sean, when we went away, you were telling us, you know, you've noticed some patterns. And you told us about the fact that there seems to be a large percentage of these sightings of our encounters with these black-eyed kids where they're wearing checkered clothing of some type, and you were about to tell us a second thing when the break took over.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, usually when I kind of describe this, and this is the first image I had in my head when I heard these stories, was I seen like the Children of the Corn type kid, or the Village of the Damned, you know, very pasty, pale complexion, and this is, you know, kind of what I imagine in my head. I, you know, obviously you can't look inside everybody's head, but I think it's kind of an archetype that it fits. But what's interesting is that in most of these interactions, the kids that are encountered are considered like kind of ethnic. They're described as Filipino, Orientals, shaped eyes in some encounters, but all usually very dark skin. Well, not very dark skin, but dark skin to where they're described as Samoan or Filipino. I've heard Haitian, I've heard Korean, which my wife is from Korea, and so that was always interesting. But that's something that I thought was notable, because if you read through, you know, some of the things in the high strangeness cases of Kiel in his Mothman Prophecies, he talks about how a lot of the men in black down there, a lot of the people that were kind of stomping around West Virginia that were kind of strange at the time, were gypsies, Oriental-looking people, that would fit into this same type of racial category. So I just thought it was kind of interesting that it's something different than what you might normally expect. You know, not the porphyria having, you know, sickly kid. It's more urban, so it's interesting.
All right, and I hope we can get all of this in before our next break. But let's go to the case of the Hellhound. You mentioned that, and you said this is one that you and your wife had investigated.
Yeah, mostly me. Do you know I'm out there in the field doing the footwork? Yeah. The Ozark Hellhound, that was originally, it started around April Fool's of 2008, and, you know, we always have to take that with a bit of grain of salt, but April Fool's is April Fool's for a reason. It's because, you know, we have a lot of high strangeness events in April, so we got, we were listening to the, well, actually my wife was listening to the local radio station, and one of the DJs was describing her daughter's encounter with this Paul the Nixa Hellhound is what they eventually labeled him. And she, you know, had described this really strange creature with the ears of a bat and the tail of a monkey and all these type of features. So I started to do a little digging into the local folklore, and we have what's called booger dogs, which is the regional slang for hellhounds because everything is booger in the Ozarks. That had stretched back to about 130 years to the 1880s. The sightings would occur about once a generation, about once every 30 years or so. It would be a flap activity, like we were kind of talking about, but it's a window area, where it would occur for about anywhere from three to four months, and all the way up to about a year, where this spectral hound, this dark hellhound would be seen, a big black dog. And we had the recent outbreak, which we'll probably get to on the other side of the break, but just the history of the hellhounds is they've always been kind of attached to the locked, hidden highways. They're attached to guardians of the dead, guardians of secrets, guardians of the spirit world, this type thing. They've always been kind of linked to the idea of death and been kind of seen as a harbinger of death and this type thing. So the sightings in recent times and back in the day basically run along Highway 13 and 65. 13 was then called Old Wilderness Road because it cut through southwest Missouri and was a major trail into Arkansas and below. And 65 is an older highway as well. So, both of those were the place where the sightings basically occurred along, both back in the day and recently. So, the origin of the hellhound, as far as we were able to tell, we talked to a lot of different sources, and we got the same story from three different sources in three different counties here in Missouri, Green, Stone, and Taney, I believe it was. Basically, was that there was this old man who lived around the turn of the century, around the 1900s, and he was very kind of standoffish. The community was very church-based, you know, very religious, and very, you know, communal. So they were very interactive with one another. This guy was a curmudgeon, didn't hang out with them. He didn't go to church on Sunday, so he was considered something of a blasphemer. Years went on, and he got older, and he eventually got on his deathbed, and His Good Samaritan neighbors gathered around his deathbed, and, you know, were trying to comfort him, you know, in his last days. And one of the farmers actually, you know, tried to do a deathbed conversion. And this is the one place where the story varies in the two tellings. One of them says that the lightning struck the hut basically and caught fire. The other says a little spark jumped out of the fireplace and started the fire. But anyways, point being the house is burning down around their ears. So four or five of these big farmers, these farm boys, you know, hay-chucking farm boys, attempt to pick up this, you know, the man, and they can't budge him. They attempt to push the bed out of the burning house and can't get him. So they eventually have to run out, and just as they clear the threshold of the door, a big black dog pushes past them and runs down the little wilderness trail off to the side through the woods. Well, the house burns down, and the neighbors are going to, you know, get the old man's ashes, who by the way his name was Wolf. His last name was Wolf, so that's invocative right there. But they were going to pick out his ashes and, you know, give him a burial, even if it wasn't a Christian one, give him a decent burial. And of course, you know, there was no bones, and the assumption being that the man was either the devil or in league with the devil and was had transformed himself into the hellhound that took off, and that's the story that we have connected to the hellhound. Now, whether or not that's true or just something that was made up after the fact to try to, you know, to explain this creature, it's interesting that, you know, enough people believed it that it was spread out over several hundred miles down here in the southwest corner, so.
Well, I'll tell you something, and part of my audience will have heard this before. I used to be international police. And at one point, I was stationed in Pristina, Kosovo. And my office was in the building that had been the headquarters for the Yugoslav version of KGB.
Right.
Okay. And in the basement of this building were, it seems to me there were four, I cannot remember exactly now how many, but they were cells, small cells. And these were used to hold prisoners that they were interrogating. At the end of the hall, there was a interrogation room. Now, what they actually did there, I don't know. But I can tell you that the floor was concrete, and it sloped from every wall sloped toward the center, and there was a drain in the center. So I had my wife with me one day and was talking about that, and she said she would like to see it. And I said, well, you know, we weren't generally supposed to go down there, but because of the position I had, I could go anywhere.
Right.
And so I took her down there and was showing her around. And we, as we came out of that interrogation room at the end of the hall, facing us, coming toward us down that hall, was a giant, I mean a huge, black German Shepherd.
Yeah.
Now, there's only two doors to get down into this thing. And the one we came in and walked down the steps locked behind us. Okay, so I'm thinking he must have already been in here.
Right.
He stops, raises his head and howls, and then he turned and ran through a doorway on the side of the hall that led to the stairs going up.
Uh-huh.
I thought, this is not good. Okay, now, it's not good because those are the stairs we had to go up to get out of there. The other entrance locks behind you, and there's no keyhole on the inside. Okay, only from the outside. The one with the keyhole on the inside is the one he went up the stairs to. So I put my hand over on my gun and very gingerly stepped through that doorway and looked up the stairs, and he was not there. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. For those of you joining us just now in this second hour, my sincere sympathy to you for missing the first hour, and welcome aboard. We're glad you finally made it. We're talking this evening with Sean Belekaroff, and he is, well, he's a paranormal investigator, and he is an author, and he approaches things in paranormal investigation from a little bit different perspective than what we normally hear. He approaches things from the perspective that the paranormal phenomena that people see and experience is directly linked or connected to certain psychological dynamics within the observer. And it's pretty interesting stuff we're talking about. Now, we'll open the telephone lines in just a moment, but right now, Sean, let me round out the story I just told about the black dog in the basement of the, it's actually the DB headquarters, and but that was, DB was their version of we're all familiar with KGB, well, that's the Yugoslav version of it. And they were no longer there. The international police were there. And this dog ran up some stairs that took you to the exit out of this basement. And the way it worked is on one end, you had a door that the key was on the outside. The keyhole was on the outside. That's how you came in and down the stairs. To leave, you had to go out these other stairs where the keyhole was on the inside and not on the outside. So when this dog howled, he then turned and ran through that little doorway on the side of the hall and up those stairs to the exit. No one who might happen to be out in the hallway could have opened the door and let this dog out because there's no keyhole on that side of the door. But he was gone. When I stepped through the door, and I was pretty nervous about it because this was a big dog, and I had my hand over on my gun, and I really didn't want to have to shoot the dog, but I really didn't want to be bit or eaten. But he wasn't there. I turned and looked at my wife, and she had stayed in the hall. I'd motioned to her to stay there while I took care of the dog, you know. I looked at her, and I must have looked strange. She said, "What?" I said, "He's gone. There's no dog there." And she said, "He has to be there." And she stuck her head through the door and looked up the stairs. The stairwell was completely empty. You talk about a few chills. I had a few chills over that. And I've never been able to explain it. And really, with my mindset, I don't have to explain it. I just say, okay, it happened. You know?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. The black dogs, the hellhounds, the old shucks, they were once one of the most reported cryptids. Now they've kind of been usurped by both Bigfoot and Nessie, which hopefully we're going to talk about Nessie being a shapeshifter.
Yeah, we'll see how the time goes with the callers. But let's open the phone lines, which is our custom in the second hour. And ladies and gentlemen, the telephone number is 623-444-5889. However, if you're in the USA or Canada and you need to call me on toll-free, then the telephone number is 888-223-4599. If you live outside of the USA and you live outside of Canada, you live anywhere else in the world, you can call our main number. It works, 623-444-5889. Or, because I don't have international toll-free, it's just not available to us. I've set up something for you, and it is called the Flash Message. So you just go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and scroll down, and under the picture of Sean, you'll see a link that says Flash Message, and just click that. You can send me a flash message. All right, to the telephone, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
How you doing, Kevin? This is Sam from Lake Havasu City.
Hello, Sam.
Sean, how are you?
Doing good, my friend. How are you doing?
Sean, fantastic. You know, I got to tell you, I've listened to a lot of this stuff, and I want to make a comment, and I have a question for you. You, my brother, are one of the most for real individuals in this whole arena of paranormal I have ever seen or read about. I ordered your book today. I cannot wait to read it. Your approach is fantastic. You're right on the mark, and I just want to commend you. And Kevin, this guy is a stellar guest. He is very, very, very right on. There's no smoke and mirrors. He comes shoot straight from the hip, and I really like this guy. It's been a great, great show. And the only really question I have for you, Sean, is where do I fill out an application to come work for you guys?
Yeah, we're always looking, and that's what makes it so great as far as with, you know, people getting out and experiencing it, because I think that's really the watermark. I think that once you experience something, that makes the whole experience, it really does crystallize in your belief system, and it changes you forever, and that's kind of what you go through. And you see that with all, like I said, all the great religions have that experience, and if you have that experience, you know, that you could chalk up the supernatural or one of these other elements, however you want to classify it, it's something that definitely changes the way you look at things. So that's definitely, you know, something we're always, we try to, where about you from?
He is from Oregon. Are you still with us, Sam?
Oregon. Oh, man. Yeah, we was out on the I was out in Washington State for almost 2 years. I got to do a lot of Bigfoot hunting and check out some of the local haunts there, and that was pretty cool. I love the Pacific Northwest. It's so beautiful out there. It's just pristine.
Yeah, I'm up there all winter long. I fight fire all summer long. I fight fire up there. I'm a firefighter during the summer, so during the fall and winter, I got a lot of time on my hands, and I spend literally probably 6 to 8, sometimes 10, 12 hours a day studying all this stuff. And all of it, and I just can't get enough.
Yeah, that's, you know, we got the library that's like got about 400 books in it. Yeah, that's you. It has to be almost a full-time job for you to really see the scope, because it's so broad and there's so many aspects to it, and it's just so encompassing at times. So, yeah, that's you. Props to you for the firefighter part. That's awesome, my friend.
All right, Sam, thank you very much for the call. 623-444-5889 or toll free at 888-223-4599. And, boy, that's kind of enthusiastic right there at the beginning, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that was my cousin from down south of the Boot Hill. that was nice. I really appreciate it, Sam. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoy the book. Contact me. Give me some feedback after you get done reading it. I'd love that.
Okay, and by the way, on your website, you have the link there for people to click where they can contact you, right?
Yeah, you can get a hold of us through spooksfield.com or paranormalcookbook.com. You can go there. We have it linked up to Amazon, Borders, Barnes & Noble, so it's pretty easy. The book's $7.99. We tried to keep it cheap so people can afford it. It's 190 pages, but it's pretty compact with information, so hopefully some people can check it out.
Very good. All right, let's talk about Loch Ness. Now, I got to tell you, Loch Ness is something that has enchanted people for a long time.
Oh, yeah, it's got a hold on the mind, for sure.
Mm-hmm. So, what's your take on it?
Okay. Well, with Loch Ness, it's kind of that situation where science looks at certain parameters it sets up and says this is impossible. And a lot of these lakes... there's not enough game, there's not enough food supply to sustain a family that would be required to have the sightings that keep occurring over and over. This is what scientists say. Now, and that is absolutely true in some of these places. Some of these places, there's lake monsters that are in man-made lakes, like in near Skinwalker Ranch. So that's, you know, something that you really, how do you have a plesiosaur in a man-made lake that's only been there for 30, 40 years? So that's always been interesting, but if you look at what Nessie really started as and what the Scottish people believe about Nessie, it's very much different than what we perceive now. They didn't look at it as like the flesh and blood cryptid that we experience it as, or has been kind of drilled into our head in the last 20 years. They were called Kelpies, which is basically a water horse, and they were thought to be basically an agent of the devil. And basically what would happen is that they would manifest as a horse. They could take on any look they want to, basically, but they would manifest as a horse standing next to the water, and when you had weary travelers that are on foot walking by, they'd get on the horse, you know, trying to get a ride. The horse would wade out and drown the men before they could, you know, say their penance and get their souls, you know, moved upstairs. Instead, they went downstairs, so that was kind of the original Loch Ness monster motif. But at the same time, this entity, this Kelpie, could also manifest as a hairy, wild man, very Sasquatch type of entity, or it could also appear as a beautiful woman seducing the traveler, all a kind of succubus type of activity. So from the very first, they kind of recognized it as a supernatural being. At the same time, when we started actually interacting, when the first written account of Nessie in the West is from the Life and Times of St. Columba. It's dated around 565 A.D., and he kind of sets the scene by the saint shows up and he's got his followers with him, and he shows up at Scotland, and there's some men that are burying one of their comrades, and as they're burying him, you know, the priest walks up, what happened? You know, well, the Loch Ness monster ate our friend and killed our friend, basically. You know, of course, the priest kind of scoffs at this and says, you know, okay, whatever. He sends one of his followers to swim out to across the loch to, you know, show that there's nothing to be scared of. So the guy sets out, and you know, everybody there hears this violent thrashing in this water, and the water just being displaced with great, you know, Arosis Force, and a couple of, you know, a couple of both the followers and the Scottish folks seeing the Nessie, you know, swimming up trying to attack this man. So he gets back to the shore, and Nessie is chased off when St. Columbia says a nice little prayer and kind of drives away the evil demon, you know, the dragon. So it really has that motif of the European Christian God versus the dragon type thing, you know. So I mean, from the own accounts of the Aboriginal people, the Scottish folk that are there, to you know, the first accounts of people that encounter it, there's an aspect of supernatural activity that's definitely surrounded around it. And that's not even getting into the really fun part. How are we doing for time?
Oh, we're doing fine. Go ahead.
Okay, good deal. Okay, there was also a reverend. Reverend Ormond was his name, O-R-M-A-N-D, and he was a native Scotch. He was a Highlander, actually, was descended from Highlanders, and they're known, you know, all over the world for having, you know, really good second sight, you know, the psychic ability. He was convinced that Nessie was a demonic-type entity. He attempted an exorcism of the Loch in 1972, and this caught the attention of the researcher Ted Halliday. He's the guy that wrote The Goblin Universe, yeah. Holiday recounted a lot of the aspects of the high strangeness he experienced while he was, investigating, Nessie. And he was up there for, you know, a year at a time, you know, good stretches, you know, months and months. It included UFOs and even a man in black type entity that was just draped in this black leather, even covered in its face. It was just a really kind of bizarre thing, and it kind of culminated with Holiday having a heart attack on the beach of Loch Ness. Then you had another researcher by the name of Tim Dinsdale. He did a film that was analyzed by the NASA people and the Air Force in 1966, where they showed it was definitely not a boat or a submarine from the signature kind of thing. Now, Dinsdale's closest associate was a fellow by the name of Eric Beckard. And Beckard had spent a lot of time out in the Loch, and he was finally convinced. He actually was kind of accosted by ghouls and demons, as he put it, as he was trying to, wait and kind of watch for Nessie one night he was out there. And they were just kind of scaring him, rocking the boat, where they'd jump in the boat and this type of thing. So he just kind of came around to the idea that it was supernatural. Now, at the International Society of Cryptozoology that was being held in England in 1986, he was trying to show a film. But they kind of snubbed him, and they wouldn't even let him show this film that he had taken. According to Dr. Jack Gibson, who was the co-sponsor of the conference, he said it was the most important he had ever seen on Nessie, end quote. And the film basically shows, and this is quote, another quote, a white shape-shifting thing that was not a reptile. So that's kind of some interesting stuff there. I think that the more we look at it, it looks like we could be talking about some type of almost an environmental archetype that's kind of sustained by consciousness. And then there was also the whole Aleister Crowley connection to the Loch Ness, where he said that he could manifest them on will. You know, he had quite the extended ego, but at the same time, he was quite the magician, according to...
All right, now, let's pause and talk about this film for a moment.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they let him show it?
Well, because... Basically, it's very hard to have a cryptozoology society that's going to deal with these things as being something that's supernatural. It has to be flesh and blood for them to really sink their teeth into it. I mean, that's why the Bigfoot reports that are filed, that where you have a Bigfoot next to a UFO, or you have a Bigfoot that, later on there's poltergeist activity breaks out, you know, they kind of tend to dismiss these things. Because they kind of really have to go with the physical evidence, and they're kind of constrained. That's what I was saying at the first, is since I'm kind of a nut and open to any source of information, I'm lucky that I can kind of just take it wherever it leads me. I don't have to have the physical parameters, but, you know, I understand where they're coming from, because they're in a very tedious position, because they're trying to stay respectable and be a respectable field, but at the same time, it's hard to take somebody seriously that, you know, believe in ghost dogs and Sasquatch being some kind of telepathic, you know, or environmental archetype, or a Native American view of a Big Brother of nature, you know, type thing. So, it's
well. Do you know who Boyd Bushman is? Do you know the name Boyd Bushman?
What, has he written anything?
Oh yes, Boyd Bushman was the senior scientist, the senior engineer at Lockheed Skunk Works for a number of years.
Okay.
Now, in talking about something that is totally different from what we're talking about, he made a statement. Right. And the interviewer said something about someone's data didn't make sense.
Right.
And Bushman said, well, your data doesn't have to make sense. It just has to be accurate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And see, there, the reason that we even have anything that we call paranormal is because we lack a scientific understanding and a scientific explanation for it.
Right.
And therefore, we classify it as paranormal. I'm of the opinion that everything that we have classified as paranormal does have an explanation, and we are just too dumb to know it yet.
Yeah, that's definitely, or in some cases, I think we look at it in a great degree of depth that we try to assign depth that isn't even there with a lot of your magical practices, a lot of your homeopathy, where just intuitively some of these shamans and people that are healers just kind of know intuitively how to do it. They don't need to explain the process. And again, that's kind of that Western trapping that we kind of get into sometimes,
mm-hmm.
because we do want to understand how it works.
Well, virtually everything in the universe is paranormal, because there's a very, very small percentage of the universe that we can explain.
Right.
So virtually everything in the universe is paranormal.
Absolutely.
Now, with this Loch Ness, you've described for us something that is a shapeshifter, and the guy said that he saw the film and that whatever it was white and not a reptile. Did he describe what it looked like other than that?
I haven't been able to find. I'm trying to find the footage as you know, as we're talking, the same as I think a lot of people have been looking and trying to. I think that some of his work was displaced, as it was with a lot of stuff that in you guys' field, a lot of things get kind of displaced, and so hopefully they can come across that, because it was supposedly very interesting footage. So I would love to see that and you know have it authenticated and get some kind of an idea of you know what you're dealing with. It's just an interesting kind of concept, because the idea that a lot of it does depend on the belief systems and all this, it kind of does fit in with the quantum physics we were talking about, where we, you know, we're kind of making this move from the old science where they had the Newtonian dead universe model to this new science where we're finding out that our belief systems are very much, you know, controlling how reality manifests. It's I think, again, when we're talking about the consciousness of being a source, I liken it to, like, if you have water in an ice tray, water representing human consciousness and the ice tray representing the mold, the preconceived thoughts, our expectation archetypes. You freeze it, it becomes crystallized manifestations, it becomes a reality, it becomes concrete. The same thing would be viewed differently if say, you had a triangle instead of cubes. You know, it's the same process, you're using the same consciousness, the same process, but at the end you're getting a different result just because it's the form, you know, what's expected, what's formed, what's holding the thought together. So, and when you talk about some of the other things like the thought projection, the tulpas, that are these, you know, entities that are seen by other people that are created as thought constructs, I think it's very interesting to kind of put it into the category of flaps, windows, and sensitives.
Well, let's talk about tulpas for a minute. What are tulpas?
The tulpas are mostly relegated to the Hindu holy men. They are entities that are constructed in the holy man's mind that do manifest in objective, so-called objective reality, where people can see it. There's a lot of tradition on that, on the eastern side. The best descriptions of it for the West has came through Alexander McNeil, I think was or Neil is her last name. She was a kind of a well-to-do aristocratic type woman from England who was one of the first to actually kind of explore the British or for the British Empire kind of explore the whatever it was, a province or whatever the Indian nation was at the time. And what she encountered, she, you know, met people that she knew. You know, one was a poet, I think another was an artist, that they had created these tulpa, these little guys that would kind of help them out but would not say anything. And she set out and went to talk to these holy men, and she finally found one that would teach her the technique. And she did her thing, and eventually she did construct a little tulpa. It was kind of, she likened it to the image of Friar Tuck in the Robin Hood stories, of kind of fat and jolly, bald-headed type of friar. He was seen, you know, by other people on the train with her, traveling, riding on a horse with her. She was seen interacting with it, but after a little bit of time, and this is kind of a common theme in these thought projection type things, it started taking on a malevolence. It started taking on kind of mean spirit. It almost seemed to kind of scowl at her and these type things. And she eventually had to kind of deconstruct it, which apparently took several months, and she finally did get it done. But that's also a common theme that we see running through a lot of these things, that if you don't pay enough attention, enough concentration, enough intent on your thought projection, if you lapse, it can kind of run amok. And it's something that we do see throughout a lot of the tulpas, the golems, the shadow entities, and some of that stuff.
All right, now what's the difference between the tulpas and the golems?
The golems are basically like prototype zombies. They're created from holy mud or holy dirt by the Jewish rabbis, and they're constructed with this mud in, and they're written a magic word. It's usually Emet, E-M-E-T, which is like life in the Jewish tongue, and it's either written on the forehead or written on a piece of paper and inserted in the mouth.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I do understand from some emails that I've gotten that there are some problems out there on the internet. It's not with us. Some people can hear us. Some people cannot. Some people are watching our television channel, and some who normally watch it cannot receive it. There are problems on the internet tonight. And again, it's not here, okay? So I don't know what the problem is. But let me give you our telephone number for those of you who are able to hear us tonight. And it is a sizable audience, though it is we are having the difficulties out on the internet. And from what it appears, most of our audience that's listening to us is actually abroad. So the problems appear to be here in the United States. But the telephone number is 623-444-5889 or toll free at 888-223-4599. Sean, let's go to the telephone and take this call. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
This is James from Texas.
Hello, James.
How are you tonight, Mr. Kevin?
I'm doing well, sir.
I hope your family's safe.
My family is safe. Disappointed and heartbroken over what's going on in their country, but safe.
Amen.
I would like to ask a question of Mr. Balikarov.
Yeah, go ahead.
Please shoot.
It amazes me that all this time no one has thought to look at Loch Ness with a child that can see the blue flame. Are you familiar with the blue flame?
Yeah, the hot one.
Well, let the rest of us in on the secret, one of you.
Yeah, you go ahead, because I want to make sure I understand it correctly.
Yeah, go ahead, James.
ability some children in Eastern Europe are found to have and probably exist elsewhere. It's just that the people in Eastern Europe are a little more apprised of what it means and its consequences. But it's the ability to see a residue that exists above buried treasure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I knew that there is definitely tradition. A lot of that in Ireland, I know in Scotland as well, this part of the second sight is being able to see the aura of both the treasure and lost, like the spirit doorway kind of things we were talking about. So yeah, that's definitely interesting. There's a lot of the stuff that we kind of have lost in our past that I think, you know, was kind of that intuitive stuff we were talking about earlier, as opposed to trying to understand exactly the dynamics of how it works.
Well, your considerations leave an openness to consider something that might very well be true with Loch Ness. Let's suppose that this is a psychic blocking, a form of psychic protection for something that's hidden of immense value.
Right.
That Nessie is simply that.
Yeah, it absolutely could be tied in, because, I mean, if you look at some of the antiquated records of, where was it? I believe it was in the Middle East. I think it's some of its Babylonian
and
Sumerian.
If you have a child that can detect that blue flame and it's shooting up into the air very high, then there's an immense treasure there that this psychic creation is guarding.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. And that, you know, definitely could be the case, because a lot of places that you do see some of these entities are very much associated with hidden treasure. Some of the chupacabra sightings, some of the more exotic ones out in the southwest have been kind of tied to hidden treasures of outlaws and bandits. I know we have some here in Missouri in the mountains that are tied to both the Hellhound and another spectral Indian type protector. So it definitely could be connected. It wouldn't surprise me in the least. And it's good to, you know, we can kind of look to the past and kind of see some of the things that our ancestors observed and kind of incorporate them into our worldview, because I think they're pretty valid and maybe lack the scientific understanding, but they're still observations, and we should, you know, treat them as part of the history of our culture.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, James, thank you for the call.
Thank you, James from Texas.
The telephone number, folks, is 623-444-5889. The toll-free number, 888-223-4599. You know, if you have a question or a comment, we'd love for you to join the conversation. Now, we were talking about golems.
Right.
And, you know, this appears, there's a golem that appears in the Lord of the Rings movie.
Yeah.
From what you've studied about golems, is that a fair representation of what they're supposed to look like?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's, I don't know if it was a nod for towards that or not. You know, with J.R. Tolkien, he didn't have a lot of too good of positive feelings for Christianity. He was kind of the contemporary opposite of C.S. Lewis. So I don't know if that was a dig or not. But no, the golem in Hebrew mythology is constructed of mud. It's a big kind of lunk of clay, and it's in, as we was talking about, the rabbi that possesses this knowledge of God could create it by writing the word Emet on their foreheads, you know, or writing it on a piece of paper and inserting it in their mouth. Then these clay gargantuan clay, you know, figures would basically carry things for the rabbis, would protect them. There's some interesting stories that have been handed down orally, mostly in the Hebrew tradition, about golems protecting the Jews from Gentile persecution and this type of thing. So it's another one of those animated forms that kind of ties in. We also kind of look at the shadow. If I don't know if you're familiar with Only the Shadow Knows.
Yeah, and we just lost the audio on our guest. Now, he warned us right at the beginning of the show that they're in a storm, so maybe that's it. Are you back now, James? Sean?
Can you hear me?
We can now.
Okay. Where did I cut out?
Well, you were just saying that you were describing the golems and
yeah.
that they there's stories about them protecting the Jewish people and so forth.
Right, right. Another interesting story was, are you familiar with the Shadow radio series from the 30s?
Oh, yeah, The Shadow Knows. Uh-huh.
Yeah, absolutely. Hans Holzer, he was one of the original ghost hunters here in America, uh-huh. did a lot of stuff in Europe, too. He wrote about the residence where the fellow Walter Gibson wrote The Shadow. He was there, Gibson was, for about 20 years, and he turned out about one novel, one of these Shadow novels, a month. So he's a very prolific writer. Spent more time and mental consideration on this character than probably any other single facet of his life. He lived there for 20 years. He eventually moved out, and had died, actually, and Hans Holzer actually didn't write about Gibson, but he wrote about the house there, and it's on 12 Gay Street in Greenwich Village, and he was told it was haunted from a journalist friend. So he goes and checks it out, and is interviewing the people, and they're talking about this entity and several people had seen it, numerous occasions at different times, and their veracity was, good veracity. And they were describing what they said was a shadow, a character that stood in the shadows, couldn't see him, had a cape, it had a big fedora hat, and it had these sparkling blue or green eyes. And if you look at the movie poster of The Shadow, the reincarnation of The Shadow in the 90s version with Alec Baldwin, that's exactly what you see, is this fedora hat covering this this shadowy figure with the cape drawn up just like it's described in this this house. So the idea being, and Hans Holzer didn't mention Walter Gibson, the idea being that maybe Gibson created something in his writing that actually stayed there after he had actually passed on. His consciousness, he created one of those thought projections, one of those tulpas that was created in his mind but had such concentration and will and efforts set on it that it actually persisted beyond his lifetime. And that's kind of the same dynamic we see with the Philip the Ghost story.
Do you know if the people who currently reside in this house are still seeing this shadow?
I've been trying to contact them through a New York ghost hunting group, and I think that actually nobody's in the house at this point because it's a historically preserved place. It was where one of the mayors used to store his liquor and his dames. It was also the house where Howdy Doody, the writer of Howdy, the guy that did Howdy Doody, lived there. So a little puppet action going on there. There's the Robert the Doll too. That was another one of those haunted doll cases that we followed. But that wasn't out of New York. That was out of Florida. So.
Okay, now let's talk about, since you brought up the shadow, what about shadow people?
Oh yeah, we're here in Missouri, so we have Zombie Road over by St. Louis, which is in the Boos Brothers Children of the Grave video with the so we're renowned for shadow people. It's one of the most prolific shadow people places in the U.S. So. The shadow folk are very interesting because they do seem, again, to correspond with a lot of other paranormal activity. Sometimes, a lot of times, and the first woman, the first book that was written about shadow people, I forget the lady's name, but it was a lady that had written it. She is really, through her experiences and people that have talked to her, kind of related as being part of the UFO experiences, it being like almost like the reconnaissance men of the Greys. So. There's that aspect, and then you have them, of course, associated with hauntings. You have a very great tradition of shadow people in all kinds of literature. I mean, you have shades and a lot of different references to shadow-type folk, even going back to Socrates and Aristotle. So it's something that's definitely being consistent, and it is one of the archetypes that's also in our mind, the shadow archetype, the unknown, the fear of the unknown. So that's definitely an interesting archetype, so it's something that's definitely kind of hardwired to our perceptual belief systems, as is the trickster, which we kind of talk about with the Curse of the Joker and the Phantom Clowns.
Let me tell you about my encounter with shadow people. Uh-huh. And it's really not my encounter, but it's while I was serving as a police chief on the island of Timor. I was in Vakeke, East Timor. And I was the commander of the police there. And one of my international policeman that worked with me there is from Georgia, and he's not the type of person that would in any way, shape, or form be thinking about shadow people.
Yeah.
But he came to me one day and asked me, do you know anything about shadow people? And I said, no, I can't say that I do. And so he told me what he had seen. Now, here's what he had seen. He rented a room at Vakeki's version of a hotel. Now, their version of a hotel is you don't have a door. What you have is a curtain over the door. There's six rooms in this small building, and each one of them has a curtain. Your window is just an opening in the wall. I'll give you the rest of it when we come back. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back right after this. Welcome back. We're on Final Approach now, and that means we have just a few minutes left in the show. The telephone number is 623-444-5889, or toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 888-223-4599. If you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, you can either call our main number, that's the 623 number, or you can send me a flash message by going to my website. Scroll down, and you'll see the link that says flash message right under Sean's photograph. So, Sean, when we went away, I was telling you about what this police officer told me. Now, this guy, he's very feet on the ground, solid as a rock, late 40s, early 50s at that time. And he said he was, and I was describing the so-called hotel. The bed has no mattress on it. It's just plywood. And so, you know, if you're going to have any kind of a mattress, what you do is you roll your sleeping bag out and sleep on top of the sleeping bag. And so he was laying there. There's no electricity at all on the island, except in the capital city. And he said during the night, he became aware that it seemed like somebody was watching him. And so he turned and looked toward the window, which is just a square hole in the wall. And he said he could see a silhouette coming through the window. He reached under his pillow, put his hand on his gun, and watched as this silhouette walked across the room and went out through the door, where the curtain was hanging.
Yeah.
And he said, but it walked close enough to him that he could see through it.
Yeah.
And that was my first experience with knowing anything about shadow people. And he asked me, he said, you know, he said, does that sound crazy? I said, no, it doesn't sound crazy. And he said, well, I've been in the police business for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And I've seen some weird stuff, but I've never seen anything like that before.
Takes the cake, huh?
Yeah, so here's a guy who has no presuppositions about
right.
shadow people, and he sees one.
Observer.
Yeah, I think you would say he's much of a believer now. But what do you think about something like that?
Do you know if the entity acknowledged him at all? Or did it seem to even sense that he was there?
Yes. After it climbed through the window, he said it stood there and it looked like it was just watching him for a while.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and that tends to be some of the more reports. There's the Hat Man, which he tends to be more predatory. He tends to be kind of more aggressive. Many of the reports are very consistent with kind of a feeling of being watched and kind of having that sixth sense up and kind of turning. And it's always interesting to hear from our fellow brothers in blue there, because those are trained observers. Those are the most upstanding type of citizens you could want, for a witness, and the ones that talk about skinwalkers and some of these other things that have been encountered. And these are guys that, we pay them because they're trustworthy. In 99.9% of the cases, these are the people we trust our society with. So they make the best, most compelling witnesses. And we've had several contact us, just to kind of get something off their chest, if nothing else. Even if they want to remain anonymous and not put it out in the field and actually have it in the literature, it's just something they need to get off their chest. And we're always glad to listen to that.
Well, there are lots of really weird things that cops see, and that they experience. And I think it's unfortunate. I can see where it may be necessary, but I think it's still unfortunate that they don't feel comfortable talking about it, because it could have a detrimental impact on their career. And that's very unfortunate.
Yeah, and I think some of social perceptions are changing, and we're kind of moving towards a different era, and like we were talking about the science going to the quantum physics universe. But with all the interest in the paranormal, and people are more likely to report things when they see, hey, I'm not the only one out there that is experiencing this. I mean, I've been in this long enough to remember, when somebody that was, going to report a UFO sighting, it was pretty much the domain of the insane crank uncle. That was, you were kind of looked at as being something of a crank, and it's kind of moved into a more legitimate position now, and just in the last 15, 20 years with the interest. So it's nice to see that there's an element of sensationalism in it, but, at the same time, it's good to see people have a general interest in it, because I think it's going to change a lot of how this stuff manifests.
We only have just maybe 3 minutes left, minute and a half, 2 minutes, something like that. Let me ask you this. Do you think it's important for us to investigate, research, and study this stuff? And if so, why?
Absolutely. If nothing else, it compels the human imagination. And Einstein, considered to be one of the most brightest minds in the last, century, said that imagination is more important than knowledge. And it's the other part of the mind that we have to use. It's the left brain or right brain, but it's the artistic side. It's that type thing that is tapped into experience, as opposed to just this book learning. And experience, like we said, is very much more concrete. So I think it's important that people experience everything they can, and that the mind remains open and questioning everything. And that's I had to get a prop to my man Keel, who just passed fairly recently, because he had such a the human condition reflected in his inquiry into everything, and looking at the broad scale and trying to understand the big picture. So I think that that's important, that we definitely need that aspect, and if we lose that, we lose a part of our own humanity.
There's you made me think of a line from an old Christmas movie, Miracle on 34th Street. Where Santa Claus says to the little girl, imagination is a nation. And he talks about how it's the most wonderful nation, it's the biggest, it's the most important nation there is, right, is the imagination.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's where all the greatness comes from. We have to have the skeptical side, that is the logical side of our brain, and that's the Western part of us, and then we have to have the Eastern mysticism and the questions and the Castanedas and all these guys out there to kind of question our understanding of reality. And luckily, we do have a lot of things to draw from, and if we just go out and look for them, I think that we'll kind of find the balance, hopefully.
Well, I have to tell you, I've been doing this show for 10 years. I've interviewed a lot of people, and this has truly been one of the most enjoyable. I've had lots of enjoyable interviews, but this ranks among the most enjoyable, and you're very well informed on the topic. and very well spoken, and I appreciate you taking the time to be with us this evening.
I had a great time, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate the exposure. Hopefully people get out and buy the book. Like I said, it's fairly cheap, $7.99. Hit up the spots, and sometime if you want to talk werewolf occult or anything else supernatural, we're always always on call.
Outstanding. If you will, Sean, just stay on the line with me for a moment as I close the show. I want to chat with you for a moment after we go off the air.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, folks. Now, let me remind you, all you need to do to go to his website is just click on his photograph on my website. That'll take you to his website. And I think you're really, really going to enjoy being at his website. I enjoyed it. It's very well put together. It's very easy to navigate. And I think it's something that's worth your time. Don't forget, if you have not yet subscribed to the K-Files, be sure you do. The K-Files, of course, is our free weekly newsletter. And it goes out every Friday. So you've got time between now and Friday to subscribe. It's free. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.